A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We delight in this podcast on talking about the weird topics and never really get their own episode in any podcast. And diplomacy provides a disproportionate amount of strange and arcane things. Therefore, we've done episodes about the honorary consuls, really fascinating facet of diplomacy, these unofficial people who run consulates. We've done one about the diplomatic pouch. I mentioned that I saw one in the flesh once. It didn't look that fancy. But two guys were rolling it up to a check-in counter at Ben Gurion Airport. And they almost did a double take. That's it. That's a diplomatic pouch. It was just a bag. But we did one about why those things are actually so important. And it was a lot more relevant to my life, not transporting diplomatic pouches, than I would have expected, because it was a lot to do with how do you get stuff from A to B if you were doing diplomacy without resting assured that no one tampered with the device. It's kind of the old school method, is you just literally watch the thing or carry it. So that's part of the reason. And there have been cases where the mechanism was completely abused, and some irreputable states argued that things that were very non-pouch-like were considered diplomatic pouches under the Vienna Accords. Here's another one that I'd love to talk about, diplomatic passports. From what I can recall, I may be mistaking Ireland with some other country, or maybe this is just the way all countries do it, but there's two grades, official passports and diplomatic passports. And being the nerdy type, I of course went on to Google Images to see, ooh, what do they look like, these diplomatic passports? And I think they have their own cover, which is kind of cool. Now, a couple of things that I'd like to ask about this, because you do hear these mentioned in the news now and again in relation to usually some kind of a scandal. Someone, you know, gets mistreated at an airport and says our diplomatic passports weren't approved or something like that. I did meet, just like the diplomatic pouch, I met someone who holds a diplomatic passport, and he was talking about an upcoming trip. Bear in mind that here in Jerusalem, where I live, we have a lot of people working in NGOs, intergovernmental stuff. And that was, so this person who I won't name for our extreme privacy measures, but was it posted at an international mission, let's say, but not diplomatic international cooperation. And not someone who I would have introduced as a diplomat, but held a diplomatic passport. So I thought that was interesting. Interesting tidbit that these people aren't always diplomats. The only other thing that I know about them, to throw in here, is you sometimes see these things show up in those kind of sketchy banner ads where, like, some kind of tin pot dictatorship is selling diplomatic passports. And I kind of wondered, okay, why? I mean, if the whole idea of diplomacy is based around nations, saying you're legit, you become legit by nations treating you as legit, which we've talked about in the fascinating concept of sovereignty in international law. By that same token, if you're just selling these things to anyone who's got a credit card, like, don't people just stop paying attention to your diplomatic passports? But anyway, for the legitimate people who hold these, the heads of states, the ambassadors, the delegations, all that stuff, what do these things actually confer upon you that us humble folk who show up to the airport for our EasyJet flight with our very undiplomatic passport, hoping that they'll let us through with our fishing coat to avoid our overcharge fees, and we skip the whole private VIP terminal we talked about before. In other words, the normal airport experience that doesn't involve. What is it like to have a diplomatic passport? Do you only use these things on official business? How many people have them? And do you get a special lounge or something? I don't know. Herman and Corin, let's talk about diplomatic and official passports in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one. Diplomatic passports. He spotted a diplomatic pouch in the wild at Ben Gurion. Met someone who holds a diplomatic passport who wasn't really a diplomat, and he's wondering what these things actually do for you. Do you breeze through airports? Do you get a special lounge? Can you only use them on official business? And what's the deal with tinpot dictatorships selling them online?
Before we dive in, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Alright, so let's start with the thing Daniel actually asked about. What does a diplomatic passport get you that my very undiplomatic sloth passport does not?
The short answer is, not as much as people think, and simultaneously more than they realize, depending on where you're standing. A diplomatic passport is fundamentally a travel document that says, the bearer is on official government business. But here's the thing, it's not a magic wand. It doesn't grant diplomatic immunity. That's probably the biggest misconception out there.
I think most people assume the passport itself is the shield. You flash the black or red or whatever color diplomatic passport, and suddenly you're untouchable.
That's exactly the misconception. Diplomatic immunity comes from being accredited to a host country. You're on the diplomatic list, the host government has accepted you, and you're operating under the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. The passport is just a travel document that says your own government considers you to be traveling on official diplomatic business. The host country gets to decide what that means at the border.
It's more like a letter of introduction than a force field.
It signals this person is traveling for diplomatic purposes, and the receiving state is supposed to extend courtesies accordingly. But what those courtesies are varies enormously. Some countries have diplomatic lanes at immigration. Daniel asked about that, and yes, in many airports you can use the diplomatic or VIP channel, but that's not guaranteed by any treaty. It's a courtesy.
I'm guessing the courtesy depends heavily on which country's passport you're holding.
A diplomatic passport from the United States or Germany opens doors differently than one from, say, Equatorial Guinea. The document is the same category of thing, but the bilateral relationship and the power dynamics are what actually determine your experience on the ground.
Let's get into the categories. Daniel mentioned he'd heard there are two grades, official passports and diplomatic passports. Is that how it works?
That's broadly correct for a lot of countries, including the United States. Issues several types. The blue tourist passport is what most people know. Then there's the maroon official passport, sometimes called a service passport in other countries, and the black diplomatic passport. The official passport is for government employees traveling on official business who don't have diplomatic status. Think military personnel being deployed or a USAID worker heading to a field office. The diplomatic passport is for foreign service officers, ambassadors, and certain high-level officials traveling explicitly for diplomatic functions.
Daniel's acquaintance in Jerusalem. Someone posted at an international mission but not technically a diplomat. That tracks. International organization staff often get a version of these documents.
The United Nations issues its own travel document, the laissez-passer, in blue for officials and red for senior officials at the D2 level and above. But member states also often issue diplomatic or official passports to their nationals who are serving at the UN or other international bodies. So you get this odd situation where someone is not a diplomat in the traditional sense. They're not accredited to a host country, they don't have immunity, but they're carrying a diplomatic passport because their own government wants them to have that document for travel.
Which creates a weird gap between what the document implies and what the person actually is.
That gap is where a lot of the abuse happens. Let's talk about the selling of diplomatic passports, because Daniel mentioned those sketchy banner ads and he's absolutely right that this is a real thing.
The tinpot dictatorship selling diplomatic passports phenomenon.
The most notorious recent case is Vanuatu. Vanuatu has a citizenship by investment program that was, for years, explicitly selling what they called diplomatic passports. Not just citizenship, actual diplomatic passports. The price was around $200,000, and they were marketing this actively as a way to get visa-free travel and diplomatic privileges.
200 grand for a diplomatic passport. What could possibly go wrong?
The European Union noticed. In 2022, the EU partially suspended Vanuatu's visa waiver agreement because of concerns about the citizenship program. By 2024, the suspension became full and permanent. The EU's concern was straightforward. Vanuatu was selling passports to people who had no connection to the country, with minimal vetting, and some of those people were using the documents in ways that created security risks.
Daniel's question about legitimacy is exactly right here. If you're just selling these to anyone with a credit card, don't countries stop taking them seriously?
That's precisely what happened. The market devalued the product. Vanuatu's diplomatic passports became less useful precisely because they were too easy to get. Border control agencies in major countries started flagging them. The EU suspension meant Vanuatu citizens, including the ones who bought in, lost visa-free access to the Schengen zone. The whole value proposition collapsed.
There's a beautiful irony there. The thing that made the passport valuable, the recognition by other states, was destroyed by the very mechanism that was supposed to monetize it.
It's not just Vanuatu. The Comoros ran a similar scheme for years, selling economic citizenship with diplomatic passport upgrades. Kitts and Nevis, Grenada. Several Caribbean nations have citizenship by investment programs, and while most of them officially distinguish between regular passports and diplomatic ones, the lines have gotten blurry enough that the EU and the United States have been pushing hard for reform.
What about the actual privileges at the airport? Daniel asked directly. Do you get a special lounge?
The honest answer is, it depends entirely on the airport, the country, and your bilateral relationship. Many major international airports do have diplomatic or VIP lounges that are separate from the business class lounges. These aren't run by airlines. They're typically operated by the host government's protocol department or foreign ministry.
It's not like you flash the passport at the Air France lounge and they usher you past the velvet rope.
The diplomatic lounge is a different thing entirely. It's usually in a separate area of the airport, sometimes with its own security screening, its own immigration processing. The idea is that a diplomat shouldn't have to stand in the same queue as everyone else, partly for practical reasons, because diplomatic travel often involves sensitive timing, and partly for symbolic reasons of reciprocity and respect.
That sounds like it would create a two-tier system at the airport that regular travelers would find infuriating.
It absolutely does, and it's one of those things that most people never see, because the diplomatic facilities are deliberately kept out of public view. They're usually accessed through a separate entrance, sometimes even a separate terminal building. The VIP terminal at Ben Gurion, which Daniel alluded to, is a perfect example. Most Israelis have never been anywhere near it.
What actually happens when a diplomat lands somewhere? Walk me through the practical experience.
Let's say a EU Foreign Service officer with a black diplomatic passport lands at Heathrow. Before arrival, the embassy in London has typically sent a notification to the Foreign Office. Our person is arriving on this flight, diplomatic passport number such and such. On landing, they can use the diplomatic channel at immigration. Their passport is processed, but the questions are minimal. The host government already knows who they are and why they're there. Their baggage may or may not be screened, depending on reciprocity agreements. And here's an important detail. The Vienna Convention says the diplomatic bag can't be opened, but the diplomatic passport holder's personal luggage is not automatically exempt from screening. That's another common misconception.
The pouch is sacred, but the person's suitcase is not.
The diplomatic pouch has specific treaty protections. The diplomat's personal baggage does not. In practice, most countries extend courtesies and don't rifle through a diplomat's suitcase, but they absolutely can if they have reasonable grounds.
What about when things go wrong? Daniel mentioned news stories about people claiming their diplomatic passports weren't honored.
This happens more often than you'd think, and it usually comes down to the distinction between a passport and accreditation. Someone shows up at an airport with a diplomatic passport from their home country, but they're not accredited to the country they're entering. The receiving state has no obligation to treat them as a diplomat. They might be treated as a regular foreign visitor, and if they start insisting on diplomatic privileges they don't actually have, things can get tense quickly.
I imagine that's especially awkward if you've been issued the passport and genuinely believe it means something more than it does.
There was a case a few years ago involving an African Union official traveling to the United States. He was carrying a diplomatic passport from his home country and was traveling on AU business, but he wasn't accredited to the EU as a diplomat. He was detained at the airport for several hours because he refused standard screening procedures, insisting his diplomatic passport exempted him. It didn't, and the situation escalated unnecessarily.
The passport is almost a trap for the uninformed. It looks important, it feels important, but unless you understand the specific legal framework of accreditation, you can get yourself into real trouble by overestimating what it does.
It connects to something deeper about how diplomacy actually works. The whole system is built on mutual recognition and reciprocity. A document is only as powerful as the willingness of the other party to honor it. There's no global enforcement mechanism, no diplomatic passport police.
Which brings us back to Daniel's point about sovereignty and legitimacy. If diplomacy is fundamentally about nations treating each other as legitimate, then a diplomatic passport is only meaningful within that web of recognition. Outside it, it's just a very expensive booklet with a fancy cover.
Daniel mentioned he looked up what they look like. He's right that many of them have distinctive covers. Diplomatic passport is black. The British one is also dark with diplomatic passport printed prominently. India's is maroon, like the regular one, but with different text. Some countries really lean into the aesthetics. Gold embossing, national symbols, the works.
I have to ask, is there a standard? Does the International Civil Aviation Organization specify what a diplomatic passport should look like?
ICAO specifies the technical standards for machine-readable travel documents, the chip specifications, the data page layout, the biometric requirements. But the cover design and the color are entirely up to each issuing state. There's no rule that says diplomatic passports must be a certain color. It's just convention that most countries make them visually distinct from ordinary passports.
The black cover is a choice, not a requirement.
A choice that's become a norm. The United States, the UK, Canada, Australia, many others use dark blue or black for diplomatic passports. But there are exceptions. China's diplomatic passport is red, so is Russia's. The color signals nothing legally. It's purely a design convention.
Let's get into numbers. How many diplomatic passports are actually out there? Daniel asked, how many people have them?
This is surprisingly hard to pin down because most countries don't publish counts. But we can make some educated estimates. State Department issues roughly 400,000 to 500,000 passports per year across all categories, tourist, official, and diplomatic. The diplomatic share is small. As of the most recent data, there are probably between 50,000 and 80,000 active U diplomatic passports in circulation at any given time.
That's tiny compared to the 150 million or so regular U.
And that's the United States, which has one of the largest diplomatic corps in the world. For smaller countries, the number of diplomatic passport holders might be in the hundreds or low thousands. But here's where it gets messy. Some countries issue diplomatic passports very liberally. Family members of diplomats often get them. Former officials sometimes get to keep them as a courtesy. Honorary consuls in some countries receive them.
Wait, honorary consuls? The people we talked about in another episode. Those unofficial representatives who might run a shipping office and do a bit of consular work on the side.
That's the group. In some countries, honorary consuls are issued diplomatic passports. Not all countries do this. The United States, for instance, does not give diplomatic passports to honorary consuls. But many others do, and this creates exactly the kind of legitimacy problem Daniel was asking about.
Because now you've got someone who's not a career diplomat, not accredited as a full diplomat, but carrying a document that says diplomatic on it.
That person might believe they're entitled to certain treatment at borders. They might not be. The receiving state may recognize them as an honorary consul for certain limited purposes, facilitating trade, helping citizens in distress, but not extend full diplomatic courtesies at the airport.
This seems like the kind of ambiguity that causes incidents.
It does, regularly. And the incidents often make the news precisely because someone is waving a diplomatic passport and being told it doesn't mean what they think it means.
What about heads of state? Daniel mentioned them. Does a president or prime minister even use a diplomatic passport?
Heads of state and heads of government frequently travel on what's called a courtesy visa or by special arrangement that doesn't require a passport at all. The receiving state simply agrees to admit them. In some countries, the head of state doesn't even possess a regular passport. They travel under a letter of credence or a special authorization. The King of the United Kingdom, for instance, doesn't have a passport in the usual sense. British passports are issued in his name, so it would be redundant for him to issue one to himself.
That's delightfully arcane. The document that authorizes travel is issued in the name of a person who doesn't need the document.
It's one of those remnants of monarchical sovereignty that persists in modern administrative practice. The logic is that a passport is a request from the issuing sovereign to the receiving sovereign to admit the bearer. The monarch is the source of that request, not the subject of it.
All right, so we've covered what diplomatic passports are, what they don't do, who gets them, and the abuse problem. Let me ask the question. I think Daniel was really driving it. What's the actual day-to-day experience of holding one? If I'm a mid-level diplomat traveling from Jerusalem to Brussels for meetings, what's different for me versus a regular traveler?
The biggest practical difference is at immigration. You use a separate channel, processing is faster, and you're not subject to the same admissibility scrutiny. A regular traveler can be asked to show proof of accommodation, return tickets, sufficient funds. A diplomat on official business isn't asked those questions. The assumption is that their government is handling all of that, and the receiving state has already agreed to their presence.
What about customs? Do they search your bags?
In theory, diplomatic status under the Vienna Convention does provide for personal baggage inspection exemptions, but only for accredited diplomats, and even then, it's subject to serious abuse safeguards. The convention says personal baggage should be exempt from inspection unless there are serious grounds for believing it contains items not for official use or personal effects. In practice, most countries are very cautious about searching a diplomat's bags because it creates a reciprocity issue. If you search theirs, they might search yours.
Reciprocity is the invisible engine of all of this.
It really is. Every courtesy extended is extended with the expectation that your own diplomats will receive the same treatment abroad. This is why even countries that are hostile to each other often handle diplomatic travel with kid gloves. Mistreating a diplomat is a direct signal about how you view the relationship.
That's what makes the selling of diplomatic passports so corrosive. It's not just about security risks, it's about diluting the signal. If anyone can buy the document stops meaning anything, and the whole system of courtesy starts to fray at the edges.
There's a related problem that doesn't get enough attention: the use of diplomatic passports by family members for personal travel. Spouses and children of diplomats are often issued diplomatic passports, and the rules about when they can use them for non-official travel vary by country. Some countries explicitly prohibit using a diplomatic passport for personal vacations. Others are looser about it. But when a diplomat's spouse shows up at a border with a diplomatic passport and no official business, it creates an awkward situation for the receiving state.
Do they get the same courtesies if they're on vacation?
They're not supposed to. The privilege is attached to the function, not the document. If you're not traveling for official purposes, you should be treated like any other foreign visitor. But in practice, the passport itself often triggers automatic courtesies that border officials extend without asking too many questions. It's one of those gray zones where the formal rules and the practical reality diverge.
Which brings me to something I've been wondering about. In the age of biometric passports and electronic travel authorizations, is the diplomatic passport becoming less relevant? If I can breeze through an e-gate with my regular passport, is the diplomatic lane still a meaningful perk?
For travel between developed countries with modern border infrastructure, the practical gap has definitely narrowed. Tourist passport holder going to the UK can use the e-gates now. The diplomatic lane still exists, but the time savings are smaller than they used to be. Where the diplomatic passport still matters enormously is travel to and from countries with more restrictive visa regimes or countries where the border process is more discretionary and less automated.
If I'm a diplomat going to a country where the visa process for regular travelers is lengthy and unpredictable, the diplomatic passport is a genuine superpower.
And it's not just about speed, it's about certainty. A regular visa application can be denied for all sorts of reasons. A diplomat on official business is almost never denied entry because doing so would be a deliberate diplomatic snub. The passport, combined with the accreditation, essentially guarantees admission.
Let's talk about the flip side for a moment. What obligations come with holding a diplomatic passport? Are there restrictions on what you can do?
Yes, and this is something that trips people up. Most countries have strict rules about what diplomatic passport holders can and can't do. You generally can't use it for private business activities. You can't use it to circumvent the visa requirements of the country you're accredited to. If you're a diplomat accredited to France, you can't use your diplomatic passport to take a side job in Paris. You're also typically required to surrender the passport when you leave government service.
I'm guessing compliance with those rules varies.
State Department has had recurring problems with former officials keeping their diplomatic passports after leaving service or using them for unauthorized personal travel. There's an entire compliance apparatus around this. The Bureau of Diplomatic Security tracks these documents and investigates misuse.
What about the physical security of the document itself? A diplomatic passport must be an attractive target for theft or forgery.
A stolen diplomatic passport is a serious intelligence and security concern. These documents are supposed to be kept in secure storage when not in use, and lost or stolen diplomatic passports have to be reported immediately, not just to the issuing government, but often to the host government as well. A diplomatic passport in the wrong hands can be used for all sorts of mischief, from identity fraud to human trafficking to espionage.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said about meeting a diplomatic passport holder who wasn't a diplomat. He said this person was posted at an international mission, not diplomatic international cooperation, he was careful to specify. What kinds of organizations issue these things?
The list is broader than most people realize. The United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the African Union, the European Union institutions, NATO. All of these organizations have staff who travel on special travel documents or diplomatic passports issued by their home countries. The UN laissez-passer is technically not a passport, but many countries treat it as equivalent to a diplomatic passport for visa and entry purposes.
Daniel's acquaintance might have been carrying a UN laissez-passer or a diplomatic passport from their home country, issued because of their UN posting.
And here's the nuance. The UN laissez-passer comes with certain privileges and immunities under the Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations, but those are functional immunities. They cover you for your official acts, not for everything you do. It's a much narrower scope than full diplomatic immunity.
Which means that at the airport, a UN official with a laissez-passer might get the diplomatic lane in some countries, but not in others, depending on how the host country interprets the applicable agreements.
In practice, UN officials often report that their experience at borders is inconsistent. One country waves them through. Another subjects them to the same screening as everyone else. The document is the same, but the host country's interpretation of its obligations varies enormously.
We've got a system where the document itself is standardized, but the experience of using it is anything but.
That's a good summary, and it reflects something deeper about international law in general. It's a system of mutual obligations without a central enforcement mechanism. Compliance depends on reciprocity, reputation, and the ongoing relationship between states. A diplomatic passport is a token in that system, not a master key.
Let's talk about the future of this. Are diplomatic passports going to remain relevant as border processes become more automated and as digital identity systems develop?
I think they'll persist, but their function will shift. The physical document may become less important as the underlying identity verification and accreditation checking moves to digital systems. But the status distinction, this person is traveling on official government business, will remain relevant because it's fundamentally about sovereignty and mutual recognition, not about the format of the document.
The black cover might disappear, but the concept won't.
And we're already seeing movement in this direction. The International Civil Aviation Organization is developing standards for digital travel credentials that could eventually replace physical passport booklets. But the diplomatic category will still exist in whatever digital system emerges, because states need a way to signal to each other that a particular traveler is on official business and should be treated accordingly.
What's the weirdest thing you came across in researching this?
Probably the fact that some countries issue diplomatic passports to religious figures. The Vatican, obviously, issues diplomatic passports to its diplomats. The Holy See is a sovereign entity with full diplomatic relations. But some other countries have been known to issue diplomatic passports to prominent religious leaders as a courtesy, which creates a fascinating blurring of church and state in the travel document space.
That feels like the kind of thing that would cause a headache for a border control officer. Is this person a diplomat or a cleric?
Or both, and neither, depending on which legal framework you're applying. It's one of those edge cases that reveals how much of the system runs on tacit understanding rather than clear rules.
All right, I think we've covered the landscape. Let me try to summarize what Daniel should take away from this. 1. A diplomatic passport is not a shield. It doesn't grant immunity. It's a travel document that signals official status, and the actual privileges depend on accreditation and reciprocity. 2. Yes, there are diplomatic lanes and lounges at many airports, but they're not universal, and they're not guaranteed by any treaty. 3. The number of genuine diplomatic passport holders is small, probably under 100,000 globally for major diplomatic powers, but the number swells when you include international organization staff and family members. 4. Yes, some countries have sold diplomatic passports, and the market has punished them for it by devaluing the document. 5. You're supposed to use these only for official business, but enforcement of that rule varies.
That's a solid summary. And I'd add one more thing. The diplomatic passport is ultimately a symbol of a relationship between states. Its power comes entirely from the willingness of the receiving state to honor it. That's why the selling schemes are so self-defeating. You can't monetize recognition without destroying the thing that makes recognition valuable.
Which is a pretty good metaphor for a lot of things in international relations, honestly.
It really is.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, marine biologists exploring hydrothermal vents off the coast of Newfoundland discovered dense colonies of tube worms living at depths exceeding 2,000 meters, with population densities reaching over 200,000 individuals per square meter in the most active vent fields.
200,000 worms per square meter. That's a lot of worms.
I'm going to need a moment with that one.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.